Guardian Unlimited.
Hi, this is the Guardian Science Podcast for October the 9th. I'm your host, Alok Jha, and I'm here in the studio with the science correspondent, Ian Sample.
Hello.
The environment correspondent, David Adam.
Hello.
And, of course, the technology correspondent, Bobby Johnson.
What's that?
Exactly. We'll be talking about whether planting trees really does anything to reduce climate change. Professor Steve Jones, the eminent biologist, will be telling us why intelligent design is stupid. And a report on the second most prestigious prizes in science. You can email us at science@guardian.co.uk or send us a Skype at gu_studio. Now, as environmentally friendly Guardian readers, you've probably come across carbon offsetting. This it was once the preserve of eco-aware celebrities like Chris Martin from Coldplay, but nowadays these schemes claim to erase the damage done by your carbon emissions by investing in projects to neutralise the pollution. We've heard of planting trees, but the offset firms also finance wind farms and other clean energy projects. Companies haven't been slow to realise the green kudos this gives them, and dozens are racing to declare themselves carbon neutral. The global market for the offsets is worth about £60 million, and it's rising fast. But not everyone's happy with it. Joining us today is Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research in Manchester. Kevin, thanks for joining us. What's your problem with carbon offsetting?
Well, immediately, my main concern is that it allows us to go to bed happy in the evening thinking that by planting some trees elsewhere in the world or possibly helping someone else buy an energy-efficient light bulb, that we've mitigated, that we've negated the impact of the carbon we've released as we've been driving our car during the day. And I don't think that's the case. I think that the emissions that we release into the atmosphere are emissions that are our responsibility and will have an impact, and that simply we are not offsetting. You cannot absorb them by some other behaviour elsewhere in the world.
I flew to Chile recently. It took me 12 hours to get there on a Jumbo 747. There were carbon emissions from that. And as an eco-aware person, I want to sort of, you know, get rid of that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So what do I do?
Well, I think once you've flown it, to be honest, you cannot get rid of that carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide will remain in the atmosphere for the next 100 or so years. And we just have to accept that, and that what we need to do, therefore, is to change our behaviour and not fly so often abroad, perhaps in the future. So we cannot offset the emissions that we release. That would be my view. It's a dangerous precedent to set. This is not to say that some of the offsetting schemes have some other benefits. I mean, planting trees may well be a good thing for other reasons.
David, you've been sort of looking into some of this stuff. People love the idea of planting trees to sort of offset their carbon. I mean, don't they?
They do, and it's a lot more than trees, I think, as we've mentioned. There's all sorts of projects now you could think of. We mentioned there the market's £60 million a year. It's projected to go to £300 million a year. Just about anyone who is anyone in terms of companies are doing it.
What kind of companies are we talking about?
Oh, well,
major international.
Avis, the car rental company, HSBC have done it very famously. They were one of the first. Sky do it. I imagine parts of The Guardian do it. I've certainly seen a lot of offset schemes advertised in The Guardian. I think, as you said, The Guardian readers, it is certainly one of their sensibilities.
I mean, as you heard Dr. Anderson say, he thinks that we're not necessarily offsetting the carbon because you can't. That carbon dioxide from my plane travels will stay in the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I spoke with a lot of the companies who sell these schemes, and what they say is that, look, they're not telling people not to take action to cut their emissions. In fact, the carbon neutral company, they say, is one of the steps in the process. They want people to work out their footprint and take steps to reduce it. HSBC, as part of their effort to go carbon neutral, did reduce their emissions. But then they were left with emissions which they said were unavoidable, mainly from staff flying around the world. Now, of course, they are technically avoidable because you don't have to fly, but I suppose HSBC would say that they were essential for its business. And so what you then get are the companies offsetting it as a way of... I think a lot of them do care about the environment, but I think it's also a very convenient PR tool to be able to save their carbon.
Ask you as your guilt. The companies offering people carbon offsetting, things, people who, you know, saying, you know, we'll plant some trees for you, that kind of thing. I mean, of course they have an interest in saying, you know, that it's a good idea.
They do, and it's worth just explaining how they work, actually, because it's not as simple as you might think. The companies themselves don't go out and plant the trees and don't build the windmills. They're operating in a market. If you operate a wind farm in Chile, for example, you can sell the carbon that you say that you're saving as carbon credits on the international market. If you're, say, when you flew to Chile, you want to offset, you're going to buy those credits, but you don't buy them directly from the wind farm in Chile. That's where these companies come in. They buy them at one price and they sell them at another. And invariably, this price they sell at is £2 or £3 more expensive than the price that they buy at.
Kevin, as well as changing our behaviour, which is obviously a longer-term prospect, I mean, surely this is a positive thing to try and at least offset your carbon?
Well, the important thing at the end of the day is we need to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere. We need to reduce that radically and quickly. You said it's difficult to change our behaviour. Actually, it's very easy to change our behaviour. We can change our behaviour this evening. And the offsetting, and that will eliminate the emissions that we no longer emit. I mean, if we go home and do not switch the television on or do not leave it on standby, those emissions will not be put into the atmosphere. It is far better to do that than to go home, leave it on standby, and buy a tree in Mozambique, which will not necessarily reduce any carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So it's a real concern to me that is allowing us to change our behaviour. The Al Gore film is said to be carbon neutral. The G8 meeting in Gleneagles last year with the British government and obviously all the other G8 governments was said to be carbon neutral. So as they travelled to the G8 meeting in their large Mercedes and other limousines, they were okay. Their conscience was clear because someone somewhere planted some trees or bought some energy efficiency light bulbs for them. That is not the right signal. That is not encouraging us to change our behaviour and is not in keeping with the level of reductions that we require in terms of our emissions.
Well, I can assure all the listeners of this programme that we're going to be trying to be carbon neutral, and certainly we took no flights on this particular podcast. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very
and
much.
David. It's an idea that refuses to lie down and die. Intelligent design, the belief that the universe is so complicated that some supernatural agent must have created it, continues to cause controversy. And it isn't just a problem reserved for the American Bible Belt. Earlier this year, there were discussions to allow creationism to school science lessons in Britain. The biologist Steve Jones from University College London is a leader in the scientists' fight back. Tomorrow, he's going to address members of the public with his thoughts on the issue. The title of his lecture is Why Intelligent Design is Stupid. I asked him to give me a preview of his talk.
The whole point of science, all science, is that you're constantly trying to disprove a theory. Okay, if I could disprove the theory of evolution, contrary to what these guys say, I'd be absolutely delighted. I'd be famous. I'd get a Nobel Prize, probably. But, of course, I can't, because it's true. These people are exactly opposed to that logic. They know what's true. What they believe can't be disproved because it's written in a big book. It's not science at all. It's antithetical to science. What it is creationism of a special kind.
One of the things that's in the proponents of intelligent design, one of their arguments seems to be that if evolution is the best way to explain how the world was is made up, then where are the sort of fossils with half-developed lungs and half-developed eyes, that kind of thing? What's the sort of best answer for that?
Well, the best answer to the claim that the fossil record is incomplete, first of all, it is incomplete, and secondly, these guys haven't bothered to go and find out how complete it is.
Why do you think it's necessary to talk about it now? Why are you sort of doing this lecture?
Well, I've always not talked about it, actually, and I don't agree that it's a debate. To call it a debate is, imagine the situation that mathematicians believe, as I understand they do, that 2 and 2 is 4, okay? Suddenly a radical new idea comes up. 2 and 2, because of something written in the Bible or in the Quran or anything like, 2 and 2 is actually 5. So all the mathematicians look in amazement at this claim. And, of course, the 2 and 2 and 5 people will get together and say, well, we want the debate. But there's no debate. What they want is a debate that comes up with a compromise. 2 and 2 is 4.1. Well, 2 and 2 isn't 4.1. 2 and 2 is 4. And evolution isn't a theory which is driven by intelligent design. It's driven by a blind mechanism, a blind watchmaker, to use Richard Dawkins' memorable phrase. And there is no room for compromise, I'm afraid. I'm not entering into debate with creationists or intelligent designers. I'm simply pointing out that their ideas are fundamentally stupid.
In the blurb, actually, for the lecture, you've got a really good example about the fact that you wear glasses. Can you sort of expand on that a little bit?
Well, I often think if there has been a designer, he wasn't a very intelligent designer. One of Darwin's... One of the classic arguments against evolution, which is used against Darwin, and Darwin was a man, just amazing intellectual prowess. God, But he has a little short section in The Origin, which is called On Organs of Extreme Perfection. And this was the old argument from intelligent design, which was the eye was so complicated that it would need a designer to do it. And what designers always said, what use is part of an eye? Well, what Darwin showed was part of an eye is a lot more use than no eye at all. But what I often think is, okay, if there's been a designer, but I would fire him, why do I need glasses, right? If my eye's been designed, why is it so unintelligent that I need to wear specs? On a broader sense, if there's an intelligence out there, why do I have a microscope there sitting over on my desk? Why does my eye allow me to see bacteria? Why, if I was an astronomer, would I need a big telescope? Because the designer would know that we need to look at the stars. But of course, it didn't happen like that. It happened by a series of successful mistakes over time to cope with the environment in which we then lived. We now live in a different environment. First of all, I'm alive rather than dead. Throughout most of human history at my age, I would have been dead. I wouldn't have to worry about my eyes going with age. We didn't need to see bacteria. We didn't need to see stars. Now we have to design things that do it. We do the designing, but we evolved. We weren't designed ourselves.
When you talk to members of the public about this, how do they react to the sort of the ideas of intelligent design? Do you find that people who think there might be an intelligent designer out there or a god, or that do they react quite violently against evolution, or are they willing to be persuaded?
They vary. I mean, the thing which I gave a talk yesterday to a bunch of people with a number of six formers in the audience, several of whom asked me the standard anti-evolutionary questions. I tried to answer them, and these people were, I hope, to a degree persuaded. Mm-hmm. And if they're willing to enter into the possibility they might be wrong, as indeed I am, any scientist always is, then I'm happy to discuss it with them. But the great majority are not willing to enter into the possibility that they're wrong, and some do get rather angry, particularly neo-fundamentalists, Christians, neo-Christians, and in Britain in particular, people who are very keen on Islam. Which is odd, really, because Islam itself, the Quran itself, says very little, actually, about the nature of the origin of humans. It says something, a simple and beautiful story, that Allah got together the clay and molded men and women. All right, it's much less explicit and complicated than the Adam and Eve story. But somehow, Islam, or I don't understand how, has taken on board the notion that somehow the belief in evolution is anti-Islamic. I can't understand that. They have nothing to do with each other. One's a science, one's a belief system, and they're not the same. The same with Christianity. In the end, I think these intelligent designers are doing far more harm to their own cause, which is, of course, religion of one flavour or another, than to my cause, which is science. And I console myself with that.
That was Professor Steve Jones talking to me about intelligent design. You can hear the full version of that interview in a Science Podcast Extra, where Professor Jones talks in exquisite detail about why Darwin was right. That's available at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. And now it's time for the news jam, where we're going to go through our favourite stories from this week. The most interesting stuff was about the Nobel Prizes. Bobby's going to take us through these one by one, I hope.
Yeah, here we
started,
go. So
we started off with physiology or medicine on Monday.
Bish, bash, bosh.
Who were the winners?
First up, we have two American geneticists who won the prize for physiology or medicine. That's Andrew Fire, who's a mere 47.
What a name.
And Craig Mello, who sounds like a really
good names.
Laid-back chap.
Mello and Fire.
And he's just 45, so these guys are pretty fast.
And they
movers.
Won for?
And they won for discovering RNA interference, which is a tool that scientists apparently will hope leads to new treatments for HIV and cancer.
That's a tool for silencing genes. Yeah. Does anyone here know what RNA interference is, or can give a quick description of it?
More or less.
Go on. You're on the clock.
When a gene switches on, it produces a little strand of RNA, which then locks into a transcript process, which turns it into a protein. RNA interference basically blocks that happening. It sends out a little intercept sequence, which stops that process.
Brilliant. Bobby, next prize.
Physics, yes. Once again, split between two people. John Mather of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland and George Smoot.
We love these
Smoot from Berkeley. It's Big Bang stuff, basically. We love the Big Bang here. Always.
We're always talking about the Big Bang or some major hard physics thing like this. I like it.
Yeah.
And what did
they
do?
You bored me already. Sorry. Okay.
You didn't bore the Nobel Committee, clearly.
But basically, they're the guys that helped prove that the universe started with the Big Bang.
And that was with the Kobe satellite in 1990. The
1989, actually.
Which went up to map the cosmic microwave background, which is a sort of fingerprint of the Big Bang now.
And then moving on, because we have to. the chemistry prize also rocked along this week, which was only one guy, so we have to give props to him.
£737,000, a lot of money for one person. Go on, yeah. Bobby, who was it?
And all the proceeds of dynamite. So another American scientist, Roger Kornberg, who studied how cells take information from genes to produce proteins.
Just a quick thing to wind that up. The chemistry and the physiology or medicine prizes were both given to people discovering how to use genetics properly. I mean, that's it just shows that this is a massive field now.
I mean, it probably is.
Oh, for the heck.
Well, genetics?
Although,
no, I don't think...
I'm more into intelligent design.
I don't think genetics is going anywhere.
Actually, I wanted to point out that because it takes quite a long time for someone to win a Nobel Prize, we're kind of seeing this is the payoff of work that was done 10 plus years ago.
The guys who got the RNAi award got it after about 8 years, I think.
Which is
speedy.
Quite quick.
Which is speedy. It's not the fastest, is it?
No, one of the fastest is 3 years for insulin.
Okay.
1923.
Well, talking about other biological type things, Ian, take us through. I'm not going to use some tabloid term for this Frankenstein monster type thing that you're about to talk
about. Shall I take the story from here?
Go on.
Okay. It's three groups of British scientists who are going to try and make stem cells from putting human cells into animal eggs. And this is something which we know has been done in Shanghai before using rabbit eggs. The reason you try and do this is there's a huge shortage of human eggs and getting hold of those isn't without risks. So if you can get a whole load of animal eggs, you can do a lot of basic research and try and get stem cells
and
from
practice
them.
Getting them, basically. Is that the idea?
Yeah,
or would you actually get therapies out
of
them?
No one's got a stem cell from a human cloned embryo so far. So after the Huang disaster. So what you can do is, you can use these, hopefully get hold of stem cells. They'll actually be so human, they'll be 99.9% human, that you can probably use them to study human diseases like motor neurone disease, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, things with a genetic component. And they're really going to use them to produce stem cells, turn them into neurons, and then they'll have the defect which causes the disease. They'll be able to watch the disease progress.
Do the research.
I
expect there's probably lots of ethical conundrums here. I mean, are there people sort of coming out and saying, you know, stop this now?
Okay, the usual reactions that certain groups have to it. Some people said that this was degrading to humanity by blurring the line of what's human and what isn't. This is a cell that you would hollow out the egg. It would leave mitochondrial DNA inside the egg, but then you put a whole cell or a nucleus into it. And as the cells proliferate, it probably becomes more human than it already was anyway. Some people have issues with that. A lot of people
I don't know. I think the from my own point of view, the benefits outweigh any potential risk of the fact that it's not a completely human thing. Does anyone else have any issues with it?
I think it's worth saying that they would never turn any of this stuff into a baby. And they would never take the stem cells and put them into people.
David, on something that I'm sure that no one can have any problems with, a way of finding more matches for DNA evidence.
You say no one, but if you're a burglar, you'd be probably...
All right, fair enough.
Pretty pissed.
No one that we care about.
Essentially, the Forensic Science Service have developed a way of separating out mixed DNA strands. We're not talking about mixed between humans and rabbits in this case. We're talking about, say, if several different people have touched a window ledge, and you come along as your forensic science suit a couple of days later and give it a swab, you get all sorts of mixed response, which until now has been pretty meaningless. You haven't been able to do anything with it. New technique allows you to basically separate out the different DNA profiles from a mixed sample.
So you can go back to old cases or anything.
That's the plan, yeah. Presumably there's thousands of cases where they've had evidence collected at the time and they haven't been able to do anything with it, or they've tried to do something with it and not succeeded. But it's still there. They've still got the swabs, they've still got the material that were found. So they can go back and use this new technique on all the old cases.
Right, thanks for that, everyone. You can get involved with any of the stories you've heard about today by sending us an email at science@guardian.co.uk, or you can comment at our blogs. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcast. Now, you've heard Bobby talking about the Nobel Prizes this year in the News Jam, and very prestigious they are too. But there was another set of awards for science last week, just as eagerly as contested as the Nobels. They are the Ig Nobels, for research that cannot and should not be reproduced. This year, the Ig Nobel laureates included a man who invented a device that can disperse unruly teenagers, and also researchers who tried to work out why the noise of fingernails on blackboards is so excruciating. I spoke to Mark Abrahams, the man behind the awards, about this year's winners and started by asking him why woodpeckers don't get headaches.
Woodpeckers are built differently than human beings.
Surprisingly.
And there are a number of features in the brain and in the way the skull is constructed and the musculature that makes it very unlikely that they're going to do damage to themselves. You could think of a woodpecker's head as being, in one sense, a giant shock absorber.
Okay.
And you would very seldom think of a human being's head as being a giant shock absorber.
I mean, they whack that wood with quite a lot of force. Could we learn a thing or two for cars?
You know, hearing you say that makes me think that this prize, I believe, will give new meaning to the old phrase, to rack your brains.
Okay. Tell me also about one of the other perennial questions that people ask. If you've ever been in a classroom where someone's scratched down a blackboard and you get that sort of spine-tingling feeling.
Yeah, well, that prize went to three people who a while ago did some experiments to try to figure out why people dislike the sound of fingernails scraping on a blackboard. And it seems to be pretty universal. Most people really do dislike it, and dislike is not a strong enough word. One of the things they discovered is it was something unexpected. You would assume, at least most people would assume, that it's the very high-pitched piece of the sound that's the most irritating. That turns out not to be true. They manipulated the sound and then played recordings, and when they removed the highest pitched or the lowest pitched, it still got exactly that same level of fright and irritation. There was another thing. It's a small mention in their paper if you read the printed study, but I think it really kind of hammers home the beautiful horror of what it was they were studying. They mentioned that before any of their volunteers listened to the sound, they were given a paper describing what the experiment would be. And most people, simply reading that they would be listening to fingernails scraping on a blackboard, got that chill down their back.
Well, it's a powerful image. I'm imagining it now, and I'm cringing a bit here in the studio, to be honest. Let's talk about something closer to home for the Brits listening to this podcast. We have our own winner from Wales.
Yes, may I say congratulations?
Thank you.
It's the man in Wales who came up with a way of broadcasting high-pitched sounds in shopping malls, the sounds that, in theory anyway, only teenagers can hear. So teenagers will be driven away from shopping malls, but adults will stick around and spend their money.
So there is some advantage to growing old and having and your ears becoming more decrepit.
Yeah, that's one way of thinking of it.
And so this is Howard Stapleton of Merthyr Tydfil. He's selling this stuff now, and this is being used to disperse crowds of unruly teenagers and things everywhere. But also, interestingly, the teenagers themselves are starting to use this to pass secret codes on to each other.
That's interesting. And then that was that led to something else even more interesting. Somebody, probably a teenager, but who knows, somebody pretty quickly figured out when they heard about Howard Stapleton's invention that you could use the same technology if you were a teenager. And if you like to bring your cell phone into school, you could use this to put a ringtone on your phone, and you could receive telephone calls in school, and the teacher would never know.
The awards are in their 16th year now. Tell me, why do you do it?
I always have trouble with that question. And the answer really is because I cannot not do it. I can't stop myself very easily.
Why do you think that scientists are so keen on these awards?
Well, I think part of it is that if you're a scientist, and probably if you're not, this probably applies to pretty much everybody in the world, no matter what you do during the course of your lifetime, no matter what wonderful things you do or what terrible things you do, most of the world simply is not going to pay attention. And it seems that every year a little bit more of the world does at least notice the Ig Nobel Prize winners. If anybody listening to this knows of somebody who deserves an Ig Nobel Prize, and this could be you yourself, the listener to this, please let us know.
Now, as you heard about the tone that only teenagers can hear, we've actually got the mosquito tone, which we can play you. Anyway, if you're a teenager and you're listening to that, tell us what it sounded like. Well, that's it from us. We've got some letters. Bobby, do the do.
Do the do. Yeah. Okay. Well, we had some response mainly on the blog this week, which was lovely.
Good.
Come again, guys.
We need more discussion.
And as the Guardian's interactive correspondent, let's go through it.
You can interact with Bobby anytime you
one,
like.
Anyway. One guy got a bit confused. I think he was talking to the football bloggers. Yeah. And said, "It's great you guys are back. I looked for weeks for you on iTunes without any success. By the way, there will never be another Zidane."
There won't.
So I don't think that one was meant for us. And then a guy called Sidekick who had emailed us before and we disgustingly neglected to talk about his questions. But he was going back to when Brian Cox came on a couple of weeks ago and asking about the Large Hadron Collider, and he seemed very perturbed by Brian's assertion that we will be guaranteed to know the origins of the universe if we can smack some particles together.
Weren't we?
In the collider.
I mean, to be honest with you, I wasn't there when Brian said what he said. Who was it? Bobby, you were here.
Who am I to argue with a man who used to play keyboards in D-Ream? But I think the point is that we can only make the best possible guess, and so we're guaranteed to find out what we think maybe the origins of the universe were. If the universe was a bowl of jelly before the Big Bang...
Which it might have been.
It might have been, but we're going to find out.
What does that
now,
mean?
If that makes any sense...
What does that mean?
It's always good to hear your thoughts, Bobby.
Yeah. Now,
go to the next letter,
moving
quickly.
On swiftly, I just wanted to point out something to someone called... Suki Bapswent.
Excuse me.
What? Well, it sounds like an insult
sounds
in a
like
foreign language or something. But anyway, she seemed to be rather irritated by the idea that we actually went and recorded the animal noises that we played to Matt last week. There is no way that you lazy hacks actually went to the zoo and recorded a lion, you big fakers.
Outrageous.
That's what Suki said.
That's
but
outrageous.
Fortunately, in the studio today, we have our producer, Georgia.
Who actually did go and do that.
And our lawyer.
Oh, well done, Georgia.
And also, she was...
Braved life and limb.
Braved lions and everything to get those.
So basically, get those Suki's right, because we didn't.
Collective podcast outfit did.
Do they think we are, that we didn't even go to the zoo and hang around with the animals?
Well,
it's not work, is it?
It's not outrageous to think that... Journalists are lazy, let's be honest.
Yeah, but going to the zoo could be classified as lazy when you're supposed to be working.
Well, it's true. Look,
so maybe let's turn it round on Suki. I think Suki was too lazy to actually write that comment on the blog and got
someone else to do it for. Right, any more, Bobby? Is that it?
No, I think we should stop me.
All right, well, remember, you can send us letters and blog entries at the usual addresses. It just reminds me for me to thank the guests in the studio, Bobby, David and Ian, and to Georgia for... producing today and for the animal noises, of course, last week, which she did honestly go and get herself. So until next week, goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.
Do you know how it actually works? I mean, what have they done?
No. I tried to find out about it in the Guardian news story, but there's very little.